All right, so thank you all for joining this Capello Fellowship phone call, and we're very excited to have our first three Capello Fellows presenting their work. So we'll be going in the order Sumer, Celine, and then Mary. Initially, we had planned to give everybody about 5 to 7 minutes, then with another 5 to 7 minutes for questions and comments. Because there are only three presenters, if you want a little bit more time, you can extend to 8 to 10 minutes, as I mentioned in an email earlier, as you see fit. And unless anybody wants to interject, I was going to suggest we get started. The one other thing I wanted to say is if folks want to stay on the call afterward to discuss the very unfortunate event in Orlando, I'm certainly happy to do that as well if we have some extra time. So, but not to take away from the what should be a celebratory call for us because of everybody's hard work, let's go ahead and welcome Sumer and hear about his project.
All right. Thank you, guys. I think this is a term we use fairly often at Iora, but I think in other places, too, when we're thinking about primary care doctors thinking about how they can sort of affect the care that their patients receive when they're not actually sitting in front of them. So this presentation is going to be about the importance of primary care involvement in the inpatient setting. So just to set the background, what I'd like to do is sort of set the background for why we ended up choosing this project and then get right into the way in which we conducted our hospital visits and then talk about some of the results and future learning that we might get out of this project. So just to set it up, I used to be a hospitalist before I became a primary care doctor, and obviously since the inception of the hospitalist movement at around 1995, we've gotten to a point right now that there's between 20 and 30,000 hospitalists in the country, depending on how you define them. And there's certainly a lot of benefits to the hospitalist model. That includes doctors who are practicing in the hospital all the time and understand inpatient medical practice really well. They're comfortable with acute changes in patient condition. That's what they're really trained to do, in addition to their sort of diagnostic acumen and tough cases. And there actually has been data that shows that when hospitalists take care of patients in the hospital, that it does make a difference. There was a New England Journal study in 2007 amongst a group in Bayview who showed that it does have small reductions in total cost of care per episode, as well as about a half-day reduction on average in length of stay. And then there's other smaller studies that have possibly shown improvements in overall efficiency in the hospital, patient satisfaction, and other things. But then, we don't always talk about the downsides of this. When a hospital is taking care of a patient, it's often the doctor who doesn't know the patient very well and doesn't know what's going on with the hospital, with that patient when they're not in the hospital. So there's little context about the social and the socioeconomic milieu in which the patient is living, what medications they're taking, what other factors play into how healthy or unhealthy they are. So the person who now knows the patient best is often not involved in their care when the patient is most vulnerable. And just to talk a little bit about my clinic. So, we take care of about a thousand high-risk super-utilizer patients that are 70% of which are Spanish-speaking, not very well-educated, blue-collar casino workers, airport workers, and bartenders who are all part of the culinary union. And in order to be in this clinic, they have to meet certain criteria, which includes one of these, either two hospitalizations in the last 12 months, two ED visits in the last 12 months, multiple comorbidities, what we call the polychronic patients, if you will, and then certain high-risk conditions like coronary disease or prior MI, CHF, anticoagulation, and then certain conditions along with any a variety of other concomitant issues, like, for example, someone who has diabetes but is also on 6 medications or has evidence of end organ damage. So I haven't listed all the criteria, but this should give you a flavor of the fact that these are pretty sick people overall. They end up visiting the ED a lot, end up getting hospitalized a lot, and our charge is to figure out how we get to make these super utilizers healthier. And on any given week, we have anywhere from 0 to 5 patients in the hospital Usually that number is 2 to 3, but you know, sometimes we trend up, sometimes we get lucky and there's nobody, and we always celebrate those weeks. So when you think about Vegas and the type of care that healthcare that kind of exists here, we often call it the Wild West, and there's this running joke, where do you go for great healthcare in Vegas? And the answer is the airport. I moved here about a year ago to actually join this clinic, and when I moved here, I was a little appalled, having come from a big academic institution, as to how the care that it delivered here is so completely the opposite of patient-centric, right? It's all driven by revenue, fee-for-service, doing more things to patients, even if it's not necessarily in their benefit. And it seemed to be just pervasive across the board, whether it was in the hospitalist, among specialists, and primary care physicians. And so here we are trying to take care of these patients who end up using the system a lot and trying to find ways to make them healthier and use the system only when they need it rather than when it suits the needs of the system itself. So with that, what we proposed to do was think about what if we as primary care doctors find a way to extend ourselves outside our clinic and actually affect their care when they're in the hospital or when they're in an acute care setting, and could we do that well? So essentially the project goals were thinking about our hospitalized patients. That goal was to see every patient who got admitted to 5 hospitals closest to the clinic, knowing that we couldn't hit everywhere all the time. Communicate with the intra-patient care team regularly to ensure that the plan is sound. Hold inpatient care teams accountable to providing evidence-based care and actually making sure that there was good two-way communication. And I should argue three-way communication involving them, us, and the patient and family, and then also to provide support and information to the family itself, which is something that was severely lacking prior to this project. Just to give you a sense of where these hospitals were located, so I don't know if you can see my mouse cursor here, but our clinic is located just to the right of center here, where the northern end of the main strip connects with downtown area. And then you can notice that we have a couple of clinics, hospitals that are about 7 minutes away, another that's about 7 to 15 minutes away. And then the furthest one away that we went to regularly were Mountain View Hospital up here, which is about 25 minutes, and then Spring Valley, which was about 20 or 22 minutes. So, you know, there was a bit of travel involved in going to all of these places, but we picked these places because it captured 70 to 80% of the admissions that our patients went to. 70 to 80% of the admissions were at these hospitals. So the format of these visits essentially was that I would touch base with the case managers each morning that were taking care of these patients regarding their status of admissions, see the patients early in the morning with our health coaches if possible, because our model is strongly based on the combination of sort of this team-led model of care where both physician and health coach are like integral to the team. Perform a mini history when we actually saw the patient, and after that, talk to the nurse, the hospitalist, specialists if needed regarding the plan of care, help them out with medication reconciliation since we have the list of medications the patient was on, and offer the services to be sort of helpful rather than hindrances by facilitating goals of care discussions if needed, updating the family and the patient on the plan of care and the need for whatever test was going on, and then providing emotional support to the team as well. And then I learned as I did this that a key aspect of the visit was advocating for patients when clearly unnecessary tests were being performed or when important things that should be done were being left out. And that's something that was arguably the most critical piece of these visits. So some of the results here that I wanted to talk about essentially was we were able to do about 126 visits since we started back in, I think it was middle of August, involving 77 patients. Patients and caregivers loved it. They were so, so happy to see that someone from the primary care team was in the hospital. Our health coaches were really very happy, although it was a struggle for them to be able to be in clinic but also find the time to be able to see their patients, but they were really happy. Contrary to popular belief or the myth, I think, that hospitalists and primary care doctors don't have the time or the desire to talk to each other, there was only one hospitalist of the 30 or so that I worked with that ever was upset that or felt like I was getting in their way and asked, why are you here? Why do you care so much? But other than that, they all seemed to there was a pretty positive relationship that was built between me and the hospitalists and the care teams that I spoke to. And then I think you guys already know this story, but I was only kicked out of the hospital once for asking too many questions. And this this picture was actually taken during our visit to the Capitol, when I went to go see Harry Reid's group for the NPA in D.C. And my team was being funny, and they added these SWAT team members escorting me out. Because it was the only picture that they could find. So generally speaking, the patients are happy, the care team is happy, the hospitalists or the intensivists are pretty happy that they're getting the information provided to them. So from a satisfaction perspective, things went really well. So now this is sort of the qualitative piece, and I'll talk about my attempts to sort of be more quantitative about this, but why it didn't work. So this is just a list of some of the procedures that were averted by ours being there. That included one transaortic valve replacement, workup and placement in a 92-year-old gentleman with advanced dementia, three EGDs on a patient who was admitted to the hospital about once a month for intractable nausea and vomiting, or a thoracentesis on the day of a patient's passing that hadn't been canceled, an unnecessary abdominal drain placement for a patient with a complicated abdominal cancer. So these were sort of like the big heavy hitters of stuff that we avoided, and I think we were all pretty proud that we were able to intervene so that patients didn't get these unnecessary things done to them. And then there were procedures that we advocated for. A patient who I did a mini history on who had unilateral vision loss for about 5 days after she was admitted to the hospital that resulted in a neuro workup, and we found that she had leptomeningeal disease, for example, in her brain. Another patient who ended up, we pushed for an exploratory laparotomy for a patient who was just floundering because nobody could figure out why he had abdominal pain. And no surgeon was willing to touch him until we basically said, do it or, you know, this is just unacceptable. And they did it and we found, like, advanced biliary cancer in him. We did 4 goals of care discussions that were very positive. We transitioned 2 patients to home instead of going to short-term rehab. And quantitatively, I tried to sort of think what is sort of the cost-effectiveness analysis of doing this type of work. And as we all know, it's very hard to figure out how much things cost in the inpatient setting. And, you know, it was basically about $324,000 of procedures that were averted. But you kind of have to balance that against the fact that sometimes you advocate for things, right, which was about maybe $23,000 or so that we advocated for. And then finally, the stuff that you can't put a price on, the goals of care discussions, the length of stay that was reduced, et cetera, et cetera. So I think overall, yes, on the cost side, there was probably a net benefit, but I decided that, you know, to put a number to it was probably even unnecessary if you actually talk about the things that you were actually able to accomplish. It was hard to sort of think about the effect on HCAHPS, which is something that we talked about doing potentially, just because at the end of the day, it's a pretty small N across multiple hospitals. There's a delay or lack of reporting on the part of patients and when it actually gets to the hospital. And then hospitals were wary of collaboration with us. And then the other part of it was that the hospitalist groups weren't even employed by the hospital. They were independent groups that were contracted to do the work in the hospital. So there were a lot of layers that made it hard to think about satisfaction from the point of view of the hospital itself. And then in terms of thinking about the results of the reduction in ED visits or readmissions, again, the small N was very small, and we also had multiple ongoing initiatives in the clinic that as a whole probably did more to reduce them than could be attributed to this small study itself. So, you know, kind of what's next and what came out of this. I was able to present this project at SGM, and it was pretty well received. This is now snowballed into a company-wide initiative to figure out what we're doing in all of our markets, from Seattle to upcoming in Miami, in terms of how this type of work fits in so that we can both reduce downstream utilization and also when patients actually are in the hospital setting, how do you make sure that they only get what they need without all the extra stuff? It's also led to me, like, sort of creating inroads with the hospitalists, specialists, and the hospitals in the city to get them to sort of get their act together. I think I've been more successful with the hospitalists and the specialists than with the actual institutions, and the emergency departments have been least likely to be interested in sort of engaging the primary care doctors to have this two-way communication. And then, you know, my ongoing efforts include continuing to find a sustainable way for PCPs not working for IORA to do this type of work. How do you think about, how do you get paid if you're in the hospital? How do you do this when you have a full schedule with patients all day long? So I think those are all questions that remain to be answered. Can this be done by other people other than doctors? Like, for example, either a nurse or a care transitions navigator who's working in your clinic but doesn't necessarily have an MD and has the ability to push out and do this type of work. So I think there's a lot of good stuff that's come out of this, and a lot of I'm very excited for what happens next as we build out this platform. And just in terms of the Coppello Fellowship, I think, you know, my conversations with Becky and bouncing ideas off my co-fellows and with Dave and everybody has given me the courage and also the sort of some of the skill set that I need to be able to advocate for these patients at a local level and as well as sort of regional as I think about, like, you know, how do I organize doctors who care about this stuff to start pushing all the other ones who aren't interested to get their act together and open up lines of communications between primary care doctors and inpatient physicians to hopefully impact care in a good way. So that's about it. I'd love to hear any thoughts or questions about what I shared with you guys.
Bravo, Sumer. An impressive body of work. At this point, just before we turn it over to questions, it appears that based on the computer, we've been joined by Tracy, Morgana, and Jonathan. If you're on the call, feel free to unmute, say hi, and then we'll open the floor.
And Chris Petrilli.
Ah, hello, Chris.
And also Jeff Huebner's here.
Hey. Hi, guys. Tracy.
Hi, lots of people on. Very good.
So any immediate reactions to Samara's work?
Hi, Samara.
Okay.
Oh.
Go ahead.
Oh, this is Celine. As a hospitalist, I'm on the other side of this. This is extremely exciting. I guess what I'm curious about is what support do you have to go into the hospital like this? What does your clinic provide you in terms of time? I got a sense of the resources with, like, the health coaches and everything, but it seems like this is – I know that I play phone tag all day long trying to get into primary care doctors, and what I'd love to have is certainly them actually see the patient in the hospital and have an in-person chat. I mean, how has that functionally worked?
Yeah, so a couple of thoughts. One is you know, our clinic is 100% capitated, so because we don't worry about fee-for-service, we don't need to worry about the volume of patients that we see in any given day. So if I need to see patients in the hospital, at home, in the clinic, on the phone, via Skype, I can do all that without worrying about how I'm going to get paid, which I understand is not the reality for 99% of the doctors out there. So that's one thing. Two is we actually have, because we have enough doctors in our clinic now, one of us, like me particularly, I tend to concentrate mostly on the walk-ins and the hospital visits and the home visits and don't carry as large of a longitudinal panel, so I can do some of the acute stuff without worrying about what's going on with the rest of my patients. And lastly, with regards to, like, you playing phone tag, almost all the hospitalists that we work with regularly have my cell phone number in their directory, and I have their cell phone number, so it's a lot easier when you can text each other and sort of wait for a response rather than calling the clinic and having the office staff saying, oh, they'll get back to you, and then playing that game for 4 or 5 hours, or sometimes that amounts to days. So I think a lot, all of those combined make it a lot easier for me to do it in my capacity than, and it speaks to that sustainability piece, which I said at the end. How can other doctors who don't have the resources and the abilities that I have to do the same type of work, or at least some semblance of it, even if it's not a full-fledged hospital visit program?
Thanks, that's helpful.
Hi, this is Lisa. I'm calling from Seattle, and I thought this was extremely exciting. You know, I have been practicing long enough that I started out and for many, many years saw my own patients in the hospital, and I was very reluctant to give that up. But when everybody else in your group is going to hospitalists, unless you want to spend your whole life rounding, you sort of have to do it. But I've seen the disadvantages. One thing I would mention on your slide on advantages to the hospitalist system, of course, is for the primary care docs is that they are expected to have increased time in the clinic and also that they get more sleep. I mean, just in general, that it reduces their burdened somewhat to not be doing the inpatients. And I, you know, I would say I've practiced in different systems where this it is a problem with fee for service for sure. Because I don't know how you get a you can't double pay. I mean, if the hospitalist is taking care of the patient, the primary care doc doesn't get paid to make rounds. And even to if you send a patient to the ER, you can't get paid note even if you spend an hour seeing them in a clinic and making that decision to do that. So that's part of the issue. But with the program I've been with most recently, which is a PACE, the Program for All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly, which is capitated from CMS, where, basically Medicare, Medicaid patients, dual eligibles. What we have done is to assign one of the providers to do hospital visits. So we rotate, and the person who's on call for the week is the one who also sees our inpatients, and they see them in conjunction with fellows in geriatrics, which makes it less of a burden, and they have reduced clinic time when they do that. But again, it's a system where you get, and definitely in that system, it is less expensive. There are fewer inpatient visits and fewer ER visits because of doing that. So you could look at the PACE model and see what some of the results are from that.
Yeah, actually, thank you for sharing that. My fellowship director is actually a PACE physician in Boston, so I do know some of their work. And I think that's an exciting model to have sort of a high-risk group in a somewhat capitated systems. And I think, at the end of the day, at Aura, we feel like fee-for-service has to go at the end of the day. Obviously, the thing is that's not going to happen overnight. And I am encouraged overall by, CMS's alternative payment models that are more, and they're getting pretty aggressive now by 2018, where you're going to start seeing primary care doctors being offered, for example, $100 per member per month care coordination fee in addition to a smaller fee-for-service component. And I think that's where, at the end of the day, where we need to go. Like, there's no doubt that it takes me 2 hours a day sometimes to do this work, and for a doc who's not getting paid, that's just not sustainable. So we have to think outside the box of how you incentivize people to do the right thing while also not worrying about their bottom line or taking care of the rest of their patients. So I totally agree with you. I think we'll get there. It's just going to take a little while, unfortunately.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, Samir. It's Tracy.
Hi, Tracy.
Go ahead, Tracy. Tracy's going to get the last question on Samir for now, just because I'm wary of time. Take it, Tracy.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, I have a quick question. Samir, so what do you think about in academics? I know you're saying it's hard, just IRO's capitation model, and you're not necessarily get necessarily reimbursed for your time, but how can we teach our younger generation coming through in residency to do the similar model so that they want to do this sort of practice once they're out of residency and training?
So you're saying, working in a capitated system in general, or, doing this type of work specifically?
Yeah, for instance, when their patients that we're following in their continuity clinic,
So I think there's a program at at Duke, for example, that starts off taking first and second year students and pairing them up with one or two really sick chronic super utilizer patients, and those students are basically given the resources and the time to be able to follow that patient wherever they are, in the hospital, at home, and they build that into their curriculum from the very beginning. And what these patients, students find at the end of the day, it's so rewarding for them to see what the patients actually go through in different stages of their health system lives, and what it's like to live at home with these conditions, and what it's like to live at be in the hospital with these types of things. And by gaining a deep appreciation for what it's actually like for these patients, they then carry that with them for the rest of their careers, really, hopefully. And are, no matter what they end up going into, primary care, specialty, whatever, and think, I need to communicate with the other doctors. I need to think about this from the patient's perspective. So I think that wherever we can build that on from the very beginning, that's the first step, right? And then, also inviting the residents from all around the country to come visit our clinic, spend a week or two rotating with us, and then taking that back and saying, okay, maybe I can't do all of this in my clinic, but what can I do? What conversations can I start in my academic life to promote this type of patient care? So I think those would be some of my thoughts.
Okay, great. Actually, I may have to look into that for my residents.
Yeah.
Okay. And so thank you, Samir. I feel that we have Harry Cho on the call, at least based on computer. So, Harry, if you're here, welcome. So, Celine, as we get ready to start off your exciting poster, I'm curious if you have it up on your computer or if you'd like to share my screen.
I do have it up on my computer, but I'm not sure how to you see it.
Do I have to kick this back to you guys?
I think I am now promoting Celine to present. So Celine, close out any other stuff on your computer because I think you're about to get your screen.
Okay, it's on my screen. It is all I see at this point, but I'm not sure if you see it.
We'll give it one more try.
If not, if you just want to make it big on your screen, I can just take it from there.
That sounds like a plan. So other
Let's
folks on the call, you see Celine's poster on my screen.
There you go. I see it.
Yep.
Wait, now I don't see it, but okay. Okay. All right, well, let's just take it from here. Okay, so everyone can see this loud and clear. All right, well, hi, everyone. Hope everyone is doing well. So I am here to present the project that I think you've all been hearing about for the last couple of months. This is the Student High Value Care Committee that we developed at Mount Sinai in New York City. And this all came about because we were trying to think of the bigger picture is how to address this unfortunate dichotomy in American healthcare where we have the highest healthcare expenditures with the worst healthcare quality. And in thinking about this problem in our High Value Care Committee, which is an initiative from the Division of Hospital Medicine, we thought about how we can address the ordering patterns that people developed during the beginning stages of their career, particularly with medical students. And other institutions have developed high-value care committees for practicing physicians and then for resident physicians. But the thing that we wanted to think about as a unique approach would be to try to get medical students involved in thinking about overutilization and how to address practice patterns even at the earliest stages of their medical training. This all came about because we have some really engaged medical students, two first-year medical students and one fourth-year medical student who we engaged very early on in the year. We reached out to the entire medical student body and had several people come, had 21 students that were ultimately accepted through an application process to our Student High Value Care Committee. And from there, we developed a curriculum, and you can see on the poster some of the curricular topics. This was very much a QI-based curriculum, but with the idea that it would lead to the foundation for experiential learning. So after an initial didactic series in the beginning of the academic year, the students then split into three teams with a faculty mentor. With the faculty mentor's help, there were brainstorming sessions, and the goal was to identify three high-value care projects. This was all medical student-driven. It was fantastic. They came up with a lot of creative ideas that I know I certainly wouldn't have thought of. And then we had the students present to a panel of sort of celebrity judges, if they can call that in the medical school, for a pitch day. And this was really exciting. This allowed them to both kind of develop the idea itself so that it could be presented, but also get a lot of meaningful feedback in a very fun, celebrity voting kind of way. after that, the pitch day, then it came down to trying to actually implement the projects. I have to say, as a mentor, this was really exciting, but at the same time, it also took a lot of work and was both on the part of the medical students, but also on the part of the faculty mentor, in part because a lot of these medical students don't have that much experience. So the project descriptions, I've put, unfortunately for space reasons, I didn't have that much space here to try to just describe the projects, but one had to do with a folate ordering, and entailed medical students handing out cereal boxes to residents and interns as they were heading in to start their day of work or finishing their night shift. And that ended up, it's become this sort of running joke now, I think, among the medicine house staff in terms of how they never order folates anymore, and then they bust other services that request them. And at least in the data that we have so far, run chart-wise, it looks like it has led to about a 50% reduction on those services over 3 months. So that's really exciting. Another team did an initiative called Think Before Ordering, looking at unnecessary labs, and came up with this mnemonic for reasons to get blood tests but otherwise consider not getting them. And we're still working on the preliminary data, but there are many picture of attendings throughout the hospital telling you not to indeed think before ordering. And then we're still working on the PPI project. That's been a little bit more challenging, but we've learned a lot from that process in terms of the importance of mentorship and getting students engaged in something that was a little bit harder, I think, in part because it required us to really engage with the intensive care unit over something rather than it really being within our domain, being hospitalists. So we're very excited to roll this out for next year. We're working over the summer to complete these or to really get these projects to the point that they can be presented at the end of the summer as a kind of culminating lecture or series, and which we'll hope will also allow for recruitment for next year's crop. Something that we're constantly talking about is how we can sustain these projects. While they're very dependent right now on a lot of medical student labor, we'd ideally like to get them operationalized so that they can continue even if we don't have medical students constantly working on Excel spreadsheets and collecting data. And then we're also working on actually getting elective credit for the students' work done on high-value care projects, and it looks like that's going to go ahead. So we're very excited. We're hoping this becomes, you know, a more permanent part of the medical student culture and hopefully lead to a whole crop of eager medical students who value high-value care and keep that practice going for the rest of their careers.
Thank you, Celine. And just immediately, it seems like you engage students so early when they're still very impressionable, and I can't help but imagine that that's going to inform the way they continue to practice. I think we'll open the floor to reactions, thoughts, questions for Celine.
Yeah, this is Steve. Celine, I'm just so excited about what you're doing. It's fantastic. Quick question. Certainly the 21 students you picked and mentored, I think are going to be future NPA leaders, so that's great. But do you think you're preaching to the choir, or are you changing people's minds?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the medical students, when they apply for this, they are coming in with a really diverse background profile. And it sounds like they're very interested in a wide range of professional interest, in that my little folate group, one wants to become an ophthalmologist, one wants to become an orthopedic surgeon, and one, I think, a pediatrician. So, it's true I'm probably preaching to the choir a bit, but I think it's also going to go much further than just the internal medicine house staff or my usual audience. What I did notice over the course of the year was we actually got a couple new recruits as people started to get the sense that the mentors were engaged, the projects were getting off the ground. I think that it's definitely picking up momentum. I'm not sure we're changing minds yet, but hopefully with time we will.
Great.
Yes. Hey, Celine, it's Sumer. This is pretty awesome. I You know, just from the in terms of the patient acquire comment, I think that's okay, right? Because I think that a lot of these people really want to do this, but just may not know how to yet. And you want to build up the capacity of these people to do this type of work, who can then infect other people who may not quite be on board with it yet. So I think we still need to preach to the choir and give them the tools that they need to be able to do this type of work, because they may want to, but not know how to approach it.
Yeah, I think that's really important. A big part of what I've been doing with these, you know, first year medical students, a lot of them come in with some research experience, because that's how you get into medical school, and kind of showing them that maybe for QI, you know, like a p-value may not be the most important thing, but seeing just people's behavior change and hearing the conversations in the elevator that, you know, oh, I never order folate anymore. Like those sort of things, I see them light up and really get excited about that. And I'm hoping that plants the seed more than anything else.
This is Aaron. I just wonder about, I mean, I agree, like the keeping people in the choir is as hard as changing minds. I mean, certainly changing somebody's mind once they've been in for a while. I wonder if there's like a sweet spot when someone is able to be like converted, and if you just, you know, if you lose them at I don't know. I'm kind of rambling here, but it just seems like there's such a huge value in catching somebody when they're open, and obviously, it's earlier than later.
I agree. I don't know where that exact sweet spot is, but I think certainly engendering this, the importance of this kind of behavior, I think is really good.
I think one big thing with this is the topic of practice variation, and just like that's, you know, no matter where you are in the spectrum, it's an important thing to learn. And it's not something that's really taught. It's almost like you're always taught that this is what's right, and med students and everybody trying to learn what's right versus everything else that's wrong. And instead of saying that, you know, some people order folate and some people don't, and it varies, suddenly mm-hmm. that kind of opens your eyes to your own self-conclusion. Anyway, sorry, I just think it's awesome.
So we'll take one more reaction or thought for Celine, as we'll attempt also to promote Mary's screen at this point. And again, as a backup, I'll take it over if need be. And the staff board is also quite ablaze with the idea that you know, keeping people in the choir is an important thing, and making sure that folks can question the training that they're going to go on to receive is an important thing.
This is Lisa, and I had a question just on how much slack these students got when they were coming in as first and second year medical students and telling the house staff and the attendings not to order certain things, you know?
Sure, yeah. So the key thing here was using something that was funny and clever and giving people food. So when you, right, I mean, since certainly with the cereal folate ordering thing, what we did is we had like a very small handout on the cereal box that explained the science behind our recommendation. And I think just that it was kind of a catchy, funny thing. Plus we educated the attendings as well. So that, I think that's why that's been successful. And the same thing with the think mnemonic, you know, have certainly, since a lot of the attendings faces are on the poster promoting this, it meant that we were able to get that that supervisor level buy-in, and then the house staff found this to be, I think, entertaining, I hope. Just waiting for us to be made fun of in the end of year video that they make every year. But yeah, so I think by trying not to take ourselves too seriously, but at the same time deliver that message, that's been very helpful and effective so far. But it has been hard, especially when you have then the hematology fellow telling them to order things, you know, that we just told them not to. And
right.
We, you know, talked with one hematology fellow, but apparently the word didn't get out to everyone. And then I'm like, oh, we need to, you know, make sure that we have some sort of education for everybody. And you can only do so much because you're only one person. And first and second year medical students can't really go in and educate hematology fellows during their noon conference. That, you know, that just isn't what they're up for. before. So it's definitely challenging, but so far at least it's been a great experience. And even if we're, you know, only able to bring down some of those ordering, some of those orders percentages by a little bit, I feel like we're making a difference.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Celine. And it looks like Mary has taken over the screen. Mary, that looks like your screen in front of us here, cardiac symmetry over you.
Okay, great.
To...
All right.
Take it away.
Awesome. All right. Thanks to the other two presenters. Those were awesome projects. So I focused my year on trying to reduce the use of cardiac telemetry in the hospital. This is something a lot of other hospitals have been able to do with great success, and I tried to kind of look into what other people were doing, other facilities were doing, and overcome some of the barriers that we faced at UNM to get that done. So we really got started because we felt like this rarely helped us in hospital medicine. It took up provider time and nursing time, and we found that it ended up creating frustrating interactions between providers and nursing and between nursing and techs regarding calls that people felt like were unnecessary. And so we didn't need any more strife in those relationships. It was frustrating for patients. Patients were constantly grateful for being able to come off the monitor. It's costly. In our facility, it leads to immobility because the patients are actually tethered to the monitor itself. We don't have the portable telemetry on all of our floors. We felt like that put patients at risk for falls. There's a well-known case report of significant delirium and tethering also associated with the telemetry use, and then alarm fatigue. So we really felt like this was a patient safety issue, putting patients that were unlikely to benefit from monitoring on the monitor, put patients that needed the monitor actually at greater risk. So those are kind of the reasons we got started. This is kind of one of the monitors that, obviously this is the ICU, but they're actually connected in our hospital, which I think is different from a lot of hospitals that are maybe newer and more technological. So we did a literature review first, and we found that as many as 99% of alarms for telemetry are false positive alarms, and that, again, contributes to that issue of alarm fatigue. The Joint Commission actually had a report where there were 80 patient deaths in a 38-month period related to alarm issues, and primarily that was alarm fatigue. And that was just reported deaths. So obviously there's a lot of underreporting when it comes to these Joint Commission reports. And then there was a really great article about alarms in non-ICU patients, and they were really quite rare. 7,200 alarms, or important alarms, were quite rare. There were 7,200 alarms studied over a two-month period in this medical, surgical, and non-ICU population, and only one was life-threatening, and that one actually terminated on its own without any intervention. 0.4% of the alarms were deemed clinically important, and only half of those actually led to management changes. So that, along with the fact that we have guidelines that suggest who would benefit, kind of pushed us forward. So we did this small audit of one of our floors with a lot of medicine patients, and we learned that about half of our patients were on the monitor, and we had this unique issue of about 10 to 20% based on various audits of patients that are on the monitor without an actual order to be on the monitor, and that's because there's easy access with the monitors being actually in the room. The leads are actually in the room, so it just patients get placed on there without any actual physician order. Only about 10% of this 50% of patients had a reason to believe they would benefit from cardiac monitoring. So we thought, again, that would push us forward to do more. So this is kind of a summary of the interventions we did. We did the interventions primarily with one hospital where we had an active nurse champion, and then with the internal medicine residents. So I've worked with the hospitalist group and presented at best practices and journal clubs. We've presented to the Nursing Executive Council, and we've created posters about appropriateness of telemetry use that are geared towards nursing and placed in nursing areas. We've delivered presentations at the nursing
nursing council meetings. And with residents, we've given them pocket cards to highlight the use of the appropriate use of telemetry and also reasons that it might not be useful or downsides of telemetry. And we actually used the Pro Chapter card and adapted that to our own institution. And then this update to Cache. So Cache is our sign-out tool, the tool that everyone prints that has information about patients on it. And we actually were able to integrate where you can visually see when you print the list which of your patients have orders for monitoring. So this is just a look at the telemetry card that you can get on the Pro Chapter website and or from Anthony. So he was able to send me an editable version of this card so that I could update it to our own local variations. We have a lot of alcohol withdrawal at UNM, and we place patients on the floor that are often in the ICU at other facilities. So our hospital policy is that those patients are on EWA, which is something we're or on telemetry, which is something that we're working to address. But at this point, that these are the guidelines for our institution. And then this is a cache tool that I had mentioned, where you can see the patient on cardiac monitoring and the patient that does not have that order, so that you can trigger that conversation when you're talking about DVT prophylaxis, glycemic control, code status, and some of the other things on that checklist. So we also did a literature review to see what had worked in other places, and this is the most frequently cited study that they basically, and they used Cerner, which is the same ordering system that we have at UNM, to hardwire requirement of a physician indication to use telemetry, and then that indication actually is associated with the duration of the order, and then nurses are in charge of discontinuation of the order at the end point. So we thought this sounded like a great idea. Unfortunately, our hospital isn't as flexible with making changes. You know, as you see here, they just did an email request for application of diagnosis-specific AHA guidelines, and 2 months later that happened. So that has not been the case here. So this is our ideal, and this is what we're pushing forward to, but it's not something we've been able to accomplish yet. This is an example of what the order would look like if we were able to get it accomplished and what they did at Christiana Healthcare to accomplish this drastic reduction in telemetry. So I've mentioned some of the barriers that we encountered. We have physical audits done by busy medical students, and so those are only done intermittently. But they've been able to, we have to do physical audits because we're also tracking this number of patients that are on telemetry without an order. But we've been able to get those audits done about once a month, and we've seen about a 10 to 15% increase in the telemetry use on that medical floor. We've had a nursing champion that was very active on 4 West, and then we had turnover where she actually interestingly moved to the cath lab. So we recruited another nursing champion and actually just got another nursing champion on a different floor as well, so we have two active nursing champions. We've had resistance at a higher level to change the computerized ordering system. The physician leader of our computerized ordering system is pretty much against anything that would require physicians to click anything extra. We have an issue with ease of practice at UNM, and his sense is that anything that would require an indication or a justification or make it at all more difficult to get what the physician wants, regardless if it's right for the patient, he's against that. So culture change in general is hard, and I think that's one of the issues that we're running up against here. But our next step, so with these active nursing champions, we're actually planning to, we've got an agreement, I think, to do the physician indication-based ordering, where physicians services that agree to use that order as opposed to the continuous order will be able to use that order, and then the nursing champions are going to lead discontinuation of those orders on the floors where we have the nursing champions. So we'll have this pilot where we have some providers doing indication-based ordering and some floors taking telemetry off automatically, and we'll be able to track the safety of that. And our hope is that with that information, we will be able to go back and say this should be done system-wide. So we're still working to kind of get input from all the key stakeholders, and that's been a big part of the last year, is trying to come up with a pilot that everyone will be happy with, that people will use, and that the outcomes of which will be enough to say, let's do this, as opposed to let's add some other things and do another pilot and that sort of thing. So that's kind of where we are with the project. And it's been, you know, I mentioned Anthony already, and he's been very helpful in terms of trying to figure out some of the issues around alcohol withdrawal and telemetry use, and also around using the pocket card to help educate residents. And it's been a good project. We have a lot longer to go. That's it.
It's a very exciting.
Oh. Yeah, at this point, we'll open the floor.
This is Chris Petrilli from U of M. Great job. I definitely hear where you're coming from with the push, but it took us 17 months to roll out our Dressler-esque type thing. But it sounds like you guys are moving in the right direction. Just what is the name of that guy that is such a barrier so that no one will hire him in the future, hopefully, if hearing his name?
Right. Oh, yeah, I don't mind telling his name, Gary Iwamoto.
Okay, that's crazy. That is just the craziest thing ever. The other thing is, did you think about having, now that you have such great nursing champions, which was actually one of our most difficult things, was nursing champions, defining them, have you thought about having, since they're going to be armed and educated, having them page the physicians saying, hey, just to let you know, this telemetry is no longer appropriate. And then maybe the physicians will start pushing back to say, but actually paging them to make it, like, very annoying so that eventually the physicians say, guys, we need to switch this to an all-indication thing because I can't get getting paged all day about this telemetry thing.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, unfortunately, that would be awesome if we could do that to Gary Iwamoto, but he's only in the ICU. No, I really like that. So as part of our pilot, once the indication has run up, they will page the physician to say they are discontinuing it. But we haven't approached perhaps while we're doing this, paging teams that aren't using that order to suggest using it or some other approaches like that. So that's an interesting thought.
Mary, something that strikes me that's very interesting is that a lot of hospitals will have this issue of overuse of telemetry, but every hospital also has sort of unique challenges, unique people who are ensconced, in your case, nurses that are empowered to put the telomeres on. And so I think it's sort of interesting that even though, Christiana, made a big success with this, their approach is not necessarily generalizable to all institutions. I was hoping you could comment on that.
I think they're on shifts. Yeah, so absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons we didn't just start off trying to just adopt their approach, because we could completely reduce the number of physician ordering, and if we don't actually achieve any culture change, then all of those patients could actually still be on the monitor and still be at risk for all of the side effects that we kind of mentioned and all the negative aspects of over-monitoring, and there would still be alarm fatigue and still be all of those other issues. So I think we really wanted to get nursing involved early in this project and generate ideas about how we can actually change the culture of overuse, because I think it's a physician and a nursing issue, and so that's kind of the way I like to talk about it here at UNM.
So any global responses to any of the presenters from tonight? Yeah, I see in the chat board, people are saying great presentation. All right, well, I think certainly from where I'm sitting, it's been a pleasure to watch these projects continue to blossom, and it seems like this would be a cause for us all to celebrate the great work that you guys have done. And we look forward to hearing the 4 more presentations in next month, same time, same hour. I'm going to take just a moment to acknowledge that, as most of you must realize, the National Physicians Alliance takes a strong view on gun violence, and I encourage folks who want to get involved with that to be in touch with Jean, and or feel free to contact me or other folks. I'm going to stop the recording. And I'll stay on for about a minute, and then we can engage in conversation if folks want to continue. Certainly also, if people need to go to bed, that's very legitimate. Again, congratulations to all. We look forward to your work next month as well.